Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we'll feature a conversation with Native American writer, photographer, and scholar Kimberly Blazer. Kimberly Blazer is an Anishinaabe activist and environmentalist. She's an enrolled member of the White Earth Nation and grew up on the reservation. She's founding director of Indigenous Nations Poets and is a past Wisconsin Poet Laureate. She's author of several poetry collections and scholarly works. She was a contributing editor for When the Light of the World Was Subdued, Our Songs Came Through, a Norton Anthology of Native Nations Poetry. She is a professor emerita at University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and an MFA faculty member at the Institute of American Indian Arts. We talked with Kimberly Blazer a couple of weeks ago in Springdale, recorded this conversation at Zion Canyon Mesa. Kimberly Blazer was an artist in residence at that time at Zion Canyon Mesa in Springdale. In this conversation, we'll learn a little bit about Kimberly Blazer's background and how she became a writer. We'll talk about her writing process, recurring themes in her work. We'll hear some poems from her latest collection called Ancient Light. We'll hear about the Language Back Initiative and Indigenous Nations Poets and much else. Here's the first part of our conversation with Kimberly Blazer. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
I want to talk about your background. You grew up on the reservation?
I grew up on White Earth Reservation. My earliest years, my very early years, were with my grandparents, and we lived off the grid, where everyone's trying to get right now.
Yeah, or everybody's trying to go back to. That's right. How was that? You didn't know anything different?
I didn't know anything different. And, yeah. You know, looking back on it, it was really quite amazing because there's a joy of being with that much family. And it's, you know, you're right there. We were fairly remote. So, like, to go to the store, my grandpa had a wagon, horse and wagon, and that was still 20 some miles away. And it was really amazing. A lot of fun stories, songs, games, cards, etc. It was a you know, a communal family in that early time. And it was short. It was a short period of time, but it's always marked to me, I think.
You went from there to a very small town.
Minomen, which in Anishinaabe Mo'an means wild rice.
Oh, it does.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that was where I spent most of my growing up years. I went to high school there. And the population of Minomen during the time I was there was 1,313. And that was actually the county seat. So in the county of Minomen, that was a significant little village.
So now going to school with, white kids, was there any tensions or anything?
So I recently went to a high school reunion, and I had such a joyful time the first night with my high school classmates, and I thought to myself, why was that so hard? Was it just angst, you know, teenage angst? And then the next day we went into the high school and we're having a tour of our old high school, and there were all these grumblings about the fact that this very Plains Indian mascot could no longer be used for the Minomen Indians, and they had to change the name and change the mascot. And suddenly it all came back to me. I remembered what that felt like. And at the time I was there, the percentage of Native students was very low, not because there weren't a lot of Native students, but most of them never made it to high school or dropped out fairly soon. I was told that the percentage of Native students now is over 70%. And when we walked into some classrooms, they had Anishinaabe Mo'an over the doors identifying the room. So there's been a huge shift in the climate of the high school. I had a few teachers who were amazing, and I had experiences that were difficult.
When did you start writing?
Was it in that period?
So weirdly, I've always written since I learned to write. And since I was tiny, I would write this very bad poetry and it got a little better. And I always did different kinds of writing. I think I began really publishing when I graduated from undergraduate. I became a journalist for a small town paper, reporter, photographer. So then I was writing all the time. I began to do literary journalism and publish in different places, but always in the background, I'm writing poetry. And then I became a graduate student at University of Notre Dame. And during that time, I was a part of a writing group where I would share my poetry. I was also a part of this very cool White Earth Land Recovery Project fundraising. So Winona LaDuke, who many people know as a former vice presidential candidate, etc., she, after graduating from Harvard, settled at White Earth and started the White Earth Land Recovery Project. So land that had been taken illegally and was tied up in courts for generations was not going to be returned easily. And she thought, let's just do an end run around that and buy back land, raise money and buy back land. So a group of us were on this many-stop tour, and I started reading my poetry in public for the very first time. And at one of the events, a publisher came and asked if they could feature it. And then shortly after that, there was this huge gathering returning the gift of more than 200 Indigenous writers from all of the Americas. And that was, it became kind of a clearinghouse where we got to see people that we admired. We began to communicate with one another and people began to invite my work. And so that's kind of how I fell into poetry.
Hmm. You have said, I was reading another interview you gave, that your very earliest poetry, you don't go back to it, you don't read it much in public because it's not that great.
This is absolutely true. I think
it's probably true for many writers.
I think it's true, but I also think about how I love the first books from many writers.
Yeah.
Even if they can now ignore them, I still love many of those poems. And I'm trying to be a better ambassador for that work because it's still taught. It's taught places. So when I go to school and schools and people want to talk about some early poem, I just try to say in my mind, that was what I was doing at the time. That was, you know, the craft level I had, et cetera. But there are poems from that very first collection that I do still like, maybe a handful, but not a whole bunch of them.
Hmm. So after college, you worked as a reporter, I think, at a newspaper.
I did.
Newspaper.
Yeah.
I want to read this quote, if I can find this here. I don't think I wrote this one down, but I can remember it. You said, as a journalist, you felt like you were in the very middle of things, but sometimes that was an illusion. That was interesting to me. Sometimes you're right in the middle of a story, right? This developing.
Yes.
Other times you just feel the excitement of new stories, I guess.
Right. I think that's it. And there's I have this nostalgia for journalism because of that feeling like you were in where everything was happening, right? And also the other part of that nostalgia is you filed a story and you were done. And now I feel like I'm never done, right? But I'll just tell you one little incident from that era. It was when the airline deregulation was going on. And the small town newspaper I worked for was Thief River Falls, Minnesota, a tiny little biweekly paper. I flew down with the city officials to Minneapolis, St. Paul, where they were holding hearings about airline deregulation. And I remember in that time realizing that this little backwards town is now like contributing to this national conversation. And one of the lines that I'll never forget is that the mayor of International Falls was making his case of why we can't take away air service from these tiny towns. And he said, International Falls is so remote that when we had a bus, it had to back into town.
That's good. That's really good. Do you think your time as a reporter informed your writing now? Did it help develop your writing at all? You're writing fast, right? You're writing for a deadline.
You're writing fast. I think Part of what has stayed with me is that I'm fascinated by people. I'm fascinated by their stories. I could meet anybody and sit down and have lunch and ask them about their life because I really want to know. You know, I really truly want to hear. I'm fascinated by anything anybody wants to tell me about their own sort of small world and the thoughts that get them through. So I think that gave me an opportunity to meet people. And later on, at another point in my life, it's kind of a funny long story, but my husband and I accidentally spent some of his parents' money right after we got married. He and his dad had the same name, and he was closing out his bank account, and he was like, whoa, I had more money than I thought. And we promptly spent it because we were just setting up a household, right? And a few months later, his mother called, not him, but me, and said, I think you guys spent our savings.
Oh, no.
So I was supposed to be writing my dissertation. Instead, I started another job in journalism, and that was a daily. And I think it's just that I did a lot. For that one, I actually did a lot of the features. And the feature reporting gets you more in touch with individuals even from all kinds of experiences and backgrounds. And I think that my curiosity continues to feed my writing. And maybe my fiction, which I'm just beginning to move into, draws on that perhaps more than my poetry, because I have known so many lives. And they sort of settle somewhere in your brain, and there's little pieces of them that will come out and find their way into a story.
You tell a story about getting into grad school, which is hilarious on one side. A lot of pieces to that. I wonder if you could tell me about
that. Sure. So I suffered from imposter syndrome. I was first generation college. My brother was he was a few years older than me. He was really the only person I knew who was in college. So he was sort of my mentor. As I was an undergraduate, my professors kept telling me, you should go to graduate school, you should go to graduate school. I didn't know what graduate school was. I literally didn't know, but I thought if I asked them, that would just prove to them that I didn't belong. So let it all go. Graduated, started my job as a reporter photographer in this small town, but I haunted the library because I love literature, I love books. And the librarian at one point told me, you should be in graduate school. And again, I just sort of let it settle, but didn't do anything. And then she handed me a book one day when I was in there, and it was about graduate programs. And I don't know what that book was, but I do know that it featured University of Notre Dame and University of Minnesota, and they were both good programs in literature. And so I started applications to both. We had a flood in Grand Forks. At the time, I was supposed to take the specialist exam for the advanced lit. Everyone takes a general exam, and then you take a specialist. But University of Minnesota didn't require it. Notre Dame did. It flooded. It was canceled. I was not in that time very assertive, and I never found out, is there another one? What should I do about this? I just let the application not be finished. I got accepted to Minnesota. I went to Minnesota. I was there. But a couple of the people that I had hoped to study with had moved on. And so now I'm sort of still, you know, settling in, and Notre Dame gets in touch with me and says, we have this unfinished application, and we wonder if you're intending to finish it this year. And then I said, well, I think I've probably missed the deadline for that advanced lit again. And I thought that was it. And then they called me back the next day and said, we decided to admit you without those scores. And then I said, I have money to go to Minnesota. I don't know if I could afford Notre Dame. So they then called me back, maybe it was a couple of days later, and they offered me a fellowship. And I didn't have to teach the first year, and I would just work. And after that, I would start teaching, and I'd be, you know, able to go. So I visited them. And it was beautiful. Like, I'm in a city. I'm not really an urban person. I was in the Twin Cities of Minnesota. So going to Notre Dame, where It has every tree that grows in North America, two lakes. It seemed much more pleasant environment for me. So I ended up, and it had a very small department. So I ended up going there. And it was, you know, in many ways, there was still the paternalism that I experienced, but it was still a really great experience for me. There's one more, like showing how naive I was at that time. I thought I had applied for the MA, and they had admitted me to the PhD. So I made an appointment with the director, the chairman of the department, and I just mentioned this to him. I say, think you have me in the wrong. He said, let's just leave that. So if you decide you want to stay, we don't have to go through the process again. And as it turned out, I stayed. I got a PhD. So good call on his part, helping me through.
So you mentioned imposter syndrome, right?
Yes.
A lot of people have that. I don't know, maybe even more prevalent with the indigenous person. But so therefore we need mentors, right? We need people encouraging us, which you had, luckily.
I didn't really have mentors at that time except my brother. Hmm. It was a little floundering, quite honestly. At Notre Dame, it was better. But I do want to say that neither in my undergraduate career nor in my graduate career did anyone ever teach any Native literature except N. Scott Momaday's Housemaid of Dawn. That was the only book. So when I wanted to do a dissertation centering on Indigenous literature, I was pretty much on my own there. And I found mentors through the Newberry Library in Chicago and so forth. But the early part of my experience was struggling, even as a newly hired assistant professor at Milwaukee. I had no mentors. I remember coming up for tenure, and this really lovely professor who ran the writing program. Just I was working at night. He had been working late. He came by my office, and he said, "I just wanted to see how the tenure process is going and who's helping you out." And everyone else had someone assisting with them. And I said, "Oh, the usual." And he said, "Which is to say?" And I said, "Which is to say no one?" And I could see in his face that that was not acceptable. The next day, someone from the department came, got in touch with me, and offered to work with me putting together my file. But I was the only Indigenous PhD to graduate the year I graduated. So I was always at that edge of, you know, trying to figure it out, not wanting to ask too many questions, and just kind of, I say blundering, but I apparently blundered well enough that it worked out. But that's also part of the reason why I wanted to change that for young writers coming after me.
Mm-hmm. Is that what Indigenous Nations Poets is?
That is what Indigenous Nations Poets is. And it actually had an earlier iteration when it wasn't quite an assistant professor yet at UWM. They brought me and allowed me one semester to work on my dissertation. So whatever I had, like maybe it was a visiting or whatever title I had at that time, within the first 10 days, I had three students of color come into my office and say, and these were creative writing students, say in the creative writing workshops, they don't get my writing, they don't honor my writing, they sometimes don't even talk about my writing. They make me explain the history that stands behind it to them. And I was like, this is not acceptable. And so they asked to work with me. And we created this non-credit, a student group called Word Warriors, which is named after Gerald Visner's work. And for 12 years, I was a mentor to a changing population of students of color with whom I would meet once a week, and they would bring work and we would workshop it. We would do readings at local bookstores. We went into schools. One year I even took them to AWP, which is a big writing conference. So that was kind of the first of that movement to try to support young writers. And then while I was at Milwaukee, the budgets for the state universities are constantly being cut, and we had gotten cut again. We had no funding really for visiting writers, because I like to bring in well-known writers that they could meet and so forth. And so I worked with Marquette University, Woodland Pattern Book Center, which is a small independent book center, MATC, Indian Community School, so five of us in UWM, and did an MOU to establish the Milwaukee Native American Literary Cooperative, where we would pool resources and twice a semester bring in writers or artists or indigenous writers, artists, et cetera, and then share them with all of our campuses and our students. And that went on for quite a while until I was encouraged, invited to create Indigenous Nations Poets. And then that is now just going into its sixth year. And that is a huge undertaking. It's been very successful, I think, because there is truly a need for this organization.
You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams, and we are talking with Kimberly Blazer, who at the time of this conversation was artist in residence at Zion Canyon Mesa in Springdale. We'll have more with Kimberly Blazer following this brief break. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're featuring a conversation with Native American writer, photographer, and scholar Kimberly Blazer. Kimberly Blazer is an Anishinaabe activist and environmentalist. She's an enrolled member of the White Earth Nation. She grew up on the reservation, and she's founding director of Indigenous Nations Poets. She's a former Wisconsin poet laureate, author of several poetry collections, also author of scholarly papers, and she is a professor emerita at University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and an MFA faculty member at the Institute of American Indian Arts. So let me just quote you. There are supposedly lines between genres, but those are not as clear for Indigenous writers, you've said. And that certainly plays out in your career, right?
It does.
You do photography, poetry, combination of photography and poetry, where you've written a play. Your book coming out next is fiction.
Correct.
So tell me about the jumping between genres and blurring the lines.
Yeah, and I don't think it's even jumping between as much as it is that if you look at a lot of well-known Indigenous writers, they've written across genres. They've mixed genres. And the person who I wrote my dissertation about, Gerald Visner, and he's just the perfect example. Everything from haiku to scholarly work, you know, critical thinking about Indigenous literatures. And, you know, Mamadé, so many people, Silco, a lot of people are creating in these genres. At the same time, it's not like you stop one and you go to another. But also, I remember some of my early scholarship. I literally would include a poem that had to do with a subject that I had written, not quoting someone else, but I made a poem about the conversation that was the critical conversation or the scholarly conversation. So I feel like my writing has never been pure in any genre, the way that the Western canon defines it. But at the same time, clearly I'm doing poetry, but this latest book of poetry, if you've looked at it, you see that it has picto poems. It has other things in it that people might not expect in a traditional poetry book. And what the thing that I love most about what people have been saying about my recent fiction is that it's so poetic. So I love that because it means that I'm keeping all of these, all the aesthetics going at the same time.
Tell me what a picto poem is.
Sure. I invented that term because it came about actually because I had made a photo. I was in a canoe with my son and it was Mother's Day, I remember, and I don't ask to go to restaurants. I ask to go on a wilderness outing. And we were in Horicon Marsh in Wisconsin in a canoe. And there was a great blue heron that was flying about, you know, getting fish, carrying them, eating them, diving, swooping. Just, you know, they're gorgeous to watch. And I had my camera. My son was turning the canoe, I was panning the camera, I made all these photos. And it felt like such a beautiful moment, kind of out of time, right? And there was a lot in my heart at that time that we were there, so that when I looked at the photos, and even though I had this stunning photo of a great blue heron with its wings extended, the feathers pointing up, the legs extended out to forever, it seemed anemic to me, because it wasn't what I saw or felt in that moment. And because I had been thinking Crane Clan, I had been thinking about, you know, the community and the stories. And I thought, how can I make this image look like what I experienced in that moment? And I thought about the Anishinaabe pictographs, which, as you know, are, you know, rock paintings, but they also often had songs that went with them. And then I thought about ledger art, indigenous ledger art, where indigenous, sometimes prisoners like the Marion prisoners, were given ledger books on which things had already been recorded, and they created this incredible artwork over the top of it. So it's like a palimpsest, and one thing is spilling into another. And I like to talk about this one in particular, which what was recorded on that ledger book was target practice. And on top of this list of target practice results, there is this beautiful spiritual picture. And so I felt like the artists, people don't know, were they conscious of what they were doing? I like to give them credit. I think they knew exactly what's happened when you bring these two conversations together, that there's a third kind of thing that happens. And so I'm trying to do the same thing by layering text and image. I'm trying to have it come alive in a way that neither one of them might individually. So kind of the texture and the gesture, I always talk about gesture. I think poetry is largely gesture, right? I think that can bring to the work or invite the reader to discover more than can be contained in a physical object.
Hmm. You've given several definitions of poetry. You just mentioned one. So you've said poetry is an act of attention.
Absolutely.
I love that. Poetry is a gesture. Mm-hmm. Poetry is participation. I wonder if you'd expand a little bit on those definitions.
Oh, of course. Yes. So I always think of poetry as an act of attention because it's you look at something and you're not looking only at the surface. I also say surface is an illusion, you know, that absolutely believe that. But what you do is you're looking and then you're seeing and then you're seeing deeper because you're paying attention. So it's that giving attention. But if you think of it from an indigenous perspective, there's always reciprocity. So there's always something coming back to you, right? And so that's why I think it's participation. I'll tell you a story. I always try to explain these things with stories. And I was kayaking on the Kuishiri River, which is in the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. And it was October, and we should not have been in our cabin because it was about to freeze over. But I went out, and I had put on a lot of clothes because it was cold. And I always take a thermos of coffee, etc. So I was tucked into a little bay, drinking my coffee and trying to tell myself, you can do this. It's not that cold, right? But I finally, after having been out a while, I realized it's too cold for me. I have to go back. And so I started paddling back. And there was an eagle overhead. So I always have my camera. And I flipped the camera up and made a photo of the eagle. And then come back to looking ahead. And when you're in a kayak, you have to watch for rocks. You have to watch for logs, you know, and in the Boundary Waters, there's always submerged, especially, you know, rocks. So anyway, I started looking forward, about to paddle again. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I did not see that rock, my head said. And then the log started swimming. And I realized that it was a black bear swimming across this little bay. And I was so mesmerized that I didn't even think about my camera. I just watched it. It was gorgeous out. The fall colors are there. This is Mukwa singing, swimming across. And then I'm like, oh, camera. So I pick up my camera. And as soon as I made that first click, he turned his head and he looked right at me. And I'm just like, bonjour, Mukwa. You know, like I greet him, right? And there's this, there's a thing. Like some people think, you know, like there's no intelligence among animals. And I believe that the natural world is all vital and intelligent. And there was something that happened in that moment. And I said probably what I sometimes say to wild creatures is, I'm nothing. I'm nothing on top of nothing. You're good. You know, just go ahead. And so then he was kind of like, if a bear shrugged, he shrugged. And then he just started swimming and he swam by me and he went up on the shore and he got up and he shook himself off and he went into the fall woods. And it, but it's that, that actually being present, and it's not just seeing, but it's being seen. So I feel like if you pay attention, if you look deeply, it's not a flat surface. There's both depth and there's return. So for me, that's how I engage in poetry. That's how I engage in photography.
I want to have you read a poem or two, just another quote. You quote Dorothea Lange, who said, we use the camera to learn to see without the camera.
Yes, because I think when you frame something in the camera lens, you're looking more closely. So it's partly that, but also it's, you see things you wouldn't see. I like when I teach haiku to my students, I have them take a piece of paper and cut out just a tiny little hole, look through that hole, and they can only write about what they see in that tiny little aperture, right? And it's amazing what you see when you concentrate your looking, when you're paying attention to some small thing. It's the same, I think, when you're looking through a camera. But there's another part of it, which is, you know, we're taught to see landscape, like to see this landscape. And in doing that, we have a different engagement than if we're seeing the watermarks on the rocks. Or were, one time I was in, I was at Story Knife in Alaska, which is in Homer, and I went on a little hike. And I was making photos of some of the flowers that were blooming and not really paying attention. So I tripped and I fell. But no big deal, I didn't get hurt or anything. But when I fell, I realized, oh my gosh, on this rock, there are all these little snails of various kinds doing interesting things. So I was able to see them because I put myself in a place to see them. And the camera allows you to put yourself in a place to see something more, see something deeper, see something close.
Mm. Well, you've got Ancient Light here, your latest book of poems. Could you read a poem or two for us?
I'd be happy to. Do you have one that you prefer?
No, just anything you'd like to choose.
Okay. Why don't I read one that is... There's an interesting trajectory in this book, and it starts out with colonization and all that colonization has wrought. And then it looks at how do we heal from that? How do we flourish as indigenous people? How do we as a larger community overcome some of the impacts of colonization, which is a state of mind as well as actions, right? And so this first poem sets the tone for what that history is and how it has impacted not just indigenous people, but our larger planet. Poem on disappearance. Beginning with our continent, draw 1491. Each mountain compass point indigenous. Trace trade routes, languages, seasonal migrations. Don't become attached. Yes, reshape by discovery, displacement, move your pencil point quickly now, as if pursued, a cavalry of possession that erases homelands. We shrink in time lapse of colonial barter, disappear. Now draw a brown face painted for ceremony, half a face, nothing. Draw nothing around a crumpled bird body, no wings. Draw emptiness inside desecrated burial mounds, a stretch of absence where fallopian tubes once curved in hope. Sketch void across Buffalo Prairie. Draw the empty of elk, of passenger pigeon, of silver trout. Conjure with your hand the shape of girl blooming, curves of face, her laughing eyes, you've seen them, postered and amber alerted, missing, evening newsed, and gone. Draw a woman wrapped in a blanket, a child's body weighted. Draw stones sinking into every river on the map. Draw carrion blackening skies, carrion plucking vision from round brown faces. Draw missing, draw murdered. Work carefully now. Turn your hand to the new continent. Again, picture it. Nothing.
That's Kimberly Blazer from her collection, Ancient Light. Thank you.
Sure.
For reading that for us. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're featuring a conversation with Kimberly Blazer. This is from a couple of weeks ago. We recorded this in Springdale at Zion Canyon Mesa, where Kimberly Blazer was an artist in residence. We'll have more following this break. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're talking with Native American writer, photographer, and scholar Kimberly Blazer. Kimberly Blazer is an Anishinaabe activist and environmentalist. She's author of several volumes of poetry, scholarly works, and she is a founding director of Indigenous Nations Poets and a past Wisconsin Poet Laureate. What would you say some of the major themes of your work are?
So, as I mentioned, that there is this settling in and looking at the consequences of a state of mind we call colonialism. And then there is a looking at what are the avenues for healing. And some of them are relationships to place. Some of them are relationships to community. I include traditional stories. I include family stories. I open out into the natural world. And I think all of these things kind of are avenues that allow us to turn away from the dark and the impact of colonization to rebuild. And so, if I could.
Yeah.
Okay, there's another poem in here. I'd love to read two more if I could. One
okay.
is one actually is about place, right? And it sort of gives that sense of how we belong to place and what that means to us as human beings. And this is called The Where in My Belly. Scientists say my brain and heart are 73% water. They underestimate me. A small island menace, I emerged among Minnesota's northern lakes. The where of Monoman, wild rice in my belly. I am from boats and canoes and kayaks, from tribal ghosts who rise at dawn, dance like wisps of fog on water. My where is White Earth Nation and white pine forests, knees summer stained with blueberries, pink lady slippers open and wild as my feet. I grew up where math was canasta, where we recited times tables while ice fishing at 20 below, spent nights whistling to northern lights. I am from old medicine barks and teas, from early, the air damp with cedar, the crack of a mick, beaver tails on water. Their echo now, a warning to where fish become a percentage of mercury, become a poison statistic, to where copper mines back against a million blue acres of sacred. I am from Nabih and Ogechidakweg, women warriors and water protectors, from seed gatherers and song makers, the wet where pulse in my belly whispers and repeats like the endless chant of waves on ledge rock, waves on ledge rock, on ledge rock, on waves on water, Nabih.
What's the title of that one again?
That's The Where in My Belly.
All right.
So I actually often ask people to find that where. What is that where for them? Because I feel like that is, strange to say, a power for us that helps us to navigate the world if we're grounded somewhere, if we allow that grounding to, you know, teach us and direct us. The other one that I wanted to share that maybe gives you a sense of another angle of this book is one that I wrote. It was actually first invited as a poem for children, and it was published in Poetry Magazine. And it's thinking about what do we need in this time? Like, some of this book was written in Trump's first term, and the divisions that he seeded then, just as now, were troubling to a lot of people. It was written just after the murder of George Floyd, and I wanted to think about what do we need as a nation. And this is a poem that in which I tried to express where the healing and the potential growth can exist. About standing in kinship. We all have the same little bones in our foot, 26 with funny names like navicular. Together, they build something strong, our foot arch a pyramid holding us up. These bones don't get casts when they break. We tape them, one phalange to its neighbor for support. Other things, like sorrow, work that way too. Find healing in the leaning, the closeness. Our feet have one quarter of all the bones in our body. Maybe we should give more honor to feet and to all those tiny but blessed cogs in the world, communities, the forgotten architecture of friendship.
That's Kimberly Blaser reading from her latest collection. It's called Ancient Light. Thank you for
Absolutely.
Reading those for us. Okay, let's hear another poem. This is also from Ancient Light.
It is.
Yeah.
And this is a poem that is about language learning and language holding, I guess. It's a little part of my prelude, and then it introduces this poem. So, Akawe, a prelude. Between languages, In the shadow of old losses, we adorn ourselves. Everywhere careful words break open, they feed us remembrance like bread. Songs like bread, Wikwandawin. Inhabited, we whisper sort tongue hungers. This blood caress of gone and almost melody. Nuji ikwe we nagamo, courting songs, how we yearn for morsels, words, memory tangle of hands kneading bakwejigan. This dollop of sweetest dough, a language prisoner's bread. This is to hunger, bakaday. This is to break, bigoshkad. To speak is to eat, Wikwandawin, feast food. Our jagged stuttering, a giveaway, muddy o iriwug. This is to share.
Beautiful. That is, again, from Ancient Light. That's Kimberly Blazer. Thank you.
Thank you.
We just have a few minutes left. I definitely wanted to get to this. Fascinating to me, the Language Back Initiative.
Oh,
tell me
yes.
about this.
So as a part of Indigenous Nations Poets, I threw out this idea that we're in the midst of, you know, many Indigenous languages disappearing. And I could talk about that, but I was always hearing land back in the news. And of course, I'm applauding this land back when lands are returned to Indigenous people. But in the back of my head, I kept hearing language back, because it's another arm of sovereignty. And it's another vessel that carries our cultural understandings and that we need to continue as Indigenous people. So I finally said it aloud in a board meeting, and everyone was like, oh my gosh, yes. So I created this pilot project where we went into two Indigenous communities in the state of Wisconsin, and we took four language instructors, poets, and we invited community members to come, and we had 2-day-long workshops in different sites in which some people were beginning language learners, some people were beginning poets, some people were more established in each of those. But what we did was to give them the tools of language, to give them the tools of poetry, and ask them to use both in writing. And why that's important is because so much of culture is embedded in the language, stories and, of course, gestures to things, teachings, traditional Indigenous knowledge is embedded in the language. If you are writing poetry, you're naturally playing with words. That gives you more ability to learn the language. It reinforces the learning. When you perform the poetry, you're bringing it back to the community, and that you're making a gift of it. I always say the language is a gift we were given, and it's meant to be returned. So one way to return that is through art, through poetry. So the performance of it both allows other people to like swim in the language and hear it, but also perhaps to encourage them in their own language journeys. And early on in Indigenous Nations Poets, at our very first, we do mentoring retreats every year. Our very first one was at the Library of Congress when Joy Harjo was our then U.S. Poet Laureate, and she was closing out her term. And we had 16 young Indigenous or emerging Indigenous writers. And one of the workshops we had for them was about using Indigenous languages in your writing. And I've just been astounded and delighted by how much they took on that and how much incredible work that they're doing with the language in the world. And it's another way to serve our communities, right? And to ensure continuum for us as Indigenous people.
How's your language doing? Anishinaabe?
Anishinaabe Mohan,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
So
a lot of speakers, or
How is the language itself?
Yeah, is it healthy at this point?
Yeah, it has. I mean, obviously, like all the languages, it has declined. There are probably more fluent speakers in First Nations people in Canada than there are in the U.S. There are some great language programs that have been initiated. I think we don't have a lot of original speakers. We don't have a great number of fluent speakers, but there are more things happening. And I think there's an energy, and we're trying to turn that corner because young, like tribal schools are teaching language. There are immersion programs, et cetera. And so some people are giving a lot of really important energy to this. And I, you know, like, we can only do so many things in the world. My own effort is to support other people as much as I can through my own organization and try to be a model. I grew up with grandparents who were, their first language was Anishinaabe Mohan, but that family was large. There were 12 kids, and the first children went to boarding school where that's where the language was, I talk about linguicide, that's where the language was killed or stolen. And my mother was at the tail end, so her first, well, she grew up mixed, but her language in school was English. She never really was fluent in Anishinaabe Mohan. Living with my grandparents in those early years and later even just being a part of that extended family, of course, I learned some Anishinaabe Mohan, and I feel like I understand more than I speak, but I still think of myself as a baby language speaker. Like, it's a very complicated language with root words and other kinds of prefixes and suffixes that make connections and say who's speaking, to whom, all of that. But I think I'm growing, and I hope that someday I would be able to say more to you. I always try to teach people about the way that the language holds story, and the longest word in the Ojibwe language is 66 letters.
Oh, wow.
Do you want to hear it?
I want to hear it, yes.
Minabashki, Minasagoni, Batosa Chagani, Badwingwash Chagani, Bakwejigan. And all of that, if you were to do a literal translation, means blueberry pie.
Oh, it does.
but there are images in there, and there's a story about the making of blueberry pie. So that's really, I think it's a great example. But there are other examples of the way that the language is embedded in, you know, like root words are embedded in different parts of the language. There's a word, ode, which is heart, and it's also in strawberry, and it's also in drum. And so you can see how those are all related. And as a poet working with that root word, that's how you can begin to, you know, fill out your language knowledge by kind of following the traces and the connections of the words. So I'm trying to be a good model. I'm trying to make places for people to do this with their poetry. And I think we've been successful at least beginning this project.
Mm. Just one more thing here at the end. Going the other way, your work has been translated into many languages.
It has.
I assume you don't speak all those languages.
I do not speak all those languages.
So I guess you just have to trust that translator, but that must be very heartening to see your work go out in so many languages.
I know. I feel really blessed that that's happened. I have a whole book out in French, and I got to tour that book, and I got to tour it with my translator, which was a wild experience. I do know some French, so I can, when that book was being put together, I could look at, for example, the intro and make a few corrections. I remember being asked a similar question when I was performing at La Maison de Poésie, which is the House of Poetry, and in the Q&A, someone said, you know, she's reciting your poems. She's translating. How do you know? So what I did in that moment was just speak a little French, because I do. So because I know that enough that I can look at what's happening. But in other languages, got to trust them. You got to know them hopefully they ask you questions. A good translator will ask a lot of questions. If someone says, I'm going to translate you, and they just do it and never speak to you again, I get a little nervous about that.
Yeah, you have to hope that they catch the nuances as much as they can.
Yeah.
So the book in French, that Résusé en dansant, is that the one?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then there is this in Anishinaabe. Iqua Ni'ime. I'm slaughtering it, I'm sure.
Yes, right. So it's Résusé en dansant is the French. And then Iqua Ni'ime dancing. Iqua Ni'ime is, it actually means the woman's dance. So it's not being directly translated in what comes after it, but Iqua Ni'ime dancing resistance. So the French is really more dancing resistance. Iqua Ni'ime, the woman's dance, dancing resistance in English.
Yeah. One final thing, your artist in residence here at Zion Canyon Mesa, what are you working on?
I have been working on many things. I have actually this invitation to do another book with a French artist who wants slight poems. And I didn't read slight poems to you today, but I have some that are all part of a group or an aesthetic that I call The Way We Love Something Small, which is that paying attention and that sort of transformation through the act of looking closely that we can experience. And so I've been working on some of those. I also have been doing a kind of weird thing that just emerged a couple of days ago. I'm writing postcards. And I thought they were postcards that were poems because they are in the form of a poem. But the postcards have begun to become a narrative. So now I'm thinking, what if I did a short story made up of postcards?
All right. We'll look forward to that. Yes. And your next book is fiction?
My next book is Red Ants. It's due out October 20th from Counterpoint Press. I'm very excited about it.
All right. We've been talking with the artist in residence right now at Zion Canyon Mesa, Kimberly Blazer. Thank you so much.
Thank you for the discussion. It's great to be with you.
Our thanks to Kimberly Blazer for the conversation. And our thanks to everybody at Zion Canyon Mesa for hosting us for this conversation. You can find Kimberly Blazer, by the way, at kblazer.org, her website, kblazer.org. Thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.